jail, he'd come and stay with us, and he'd steal money out of his mother's purse so he could drink and stuff like that, you know. So I grew up with resentments. You know, I never heard of the word, but I hadn't. And I had a lot of contempt for the people that raised me and the family I grew up in. I went to the house I grew up in was, the female was a Catholic and the male was an atheist. And that, you get a little mixed messages there. And she required me to go to a Catholic school for my first 9 years of any kind of schooling. So, and the nuns that taught at that school are the same ones that taught my mother and my uncles, and they were all alcoholics. And they took me there and turned me loose. I said, "Oh God, I'm screwed already," you know. And by the time I started probably stealing cigarettes and stuff when I was about 10 years old, because I wanted to be a bigger guy. And I started hanging out with a preacher's son, and his father had a wet bar in the basement of their house. And we would go down there and sample a little of this and a little of that and a little other stuff. And so I got started pretty early with this stuff. And when I put alcohol in my system, something happens. That's what it says in the big book. When an alcoholic drinks, something happens. Well, something better happened. That's why I'm doing it. I found out why those people drank alcohol. I love, in the doctor's opinion in our book, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Alcohol is magic stuff. If you have alcoholism, you know. I met a couple of social drinkers in my history, and they don't make any sense. My ex-wife and I invited one of her girlfriends one time to go out with us to have a few drinks, and I had five or six drinks that already, and the woman I was married to had three or four. And when I got up to go get us another drink, this girl handed me her drink and said, "Would you ask the bartender to put fresh ice in this? The ice melted." And I said, "Honey, why don't you just drink that and I'll get you another drink?" She said, "No, if I do that, I'll start get a funny, out-of-control feeling, and I hate that feeling." So, there's something seriously wrong with that woman. I'm going to do a lot to get that feeling. It's going to cost me everything I got in my pocket, and maybe in the whole world. But I'm going for the feeling, it scares. The non-alcoholics never get to do the stuff we get to do. They don't even get intoxicated. They have like a drink or a drink and a half, and that's it. And they quit and go about, what the hell is that about? You know? I went with the guy on the forehead. I don't think I'm the only alcoholic in here. So I got about halfway serious about drinking when I was about 15 years old. And by the time I was 17, I had had several blackouts. Don't like having those. I woke up one morning asleep on my uncle's front porch. My car was out in the street with the headlights on and the engine running. The door's open, and I don't remember how I got there. But it would appear I drove the car. And, you know, that's I woke up one morning walking down a street up in Fresno where I used to live, and it was about 7 o'clock in the morning, and the last thing I remember was 9 o'clock the night before when the cops deposited me in a place and told me, "Don't move until you get sober." And I said, "Okay, right, that's going to happen." And I was put in jail one time when I was 18 years old, and I was arrested for Well, my name's in the Sacramento, was in the Sacramento Bee, being recently arrested for being a dumbass, and so I don't bother with anonymity. And after each one of those things would happen to me, I would say to myself, the only higher power I knew, I'm never going to get that drunk again. I'm not going to quit drinking because I like to drink. I like the way it makes me feel, man. I heard a guy describe that one time. You pour it in there and you swallow it and you feel that warmth going down in here. And then when it gets down to the belly, it goes poof. And then in a minute, you can feel it coming back up and you feel it in your ears get red. And it's, oh. I think we just lost three newcomers. So the effect is, whatever was bothering me 10 minutes ago, that didn't even matter anymore. The world can be pissed off at me. It doesn't matter. No matter, I might have been afraid. Now I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid to ask the girls to dance. Not afraid to strike up a conversation with somebody I don't know. I'm not afraid of nothing now because I got that magic leopard sweat in me. And but sometimes those blackouts got really interesting. I went down and saw a Navy recruiter when I was 17 years old. I grew up back in the Midwest. One of the people that was raising me passed away. I moved to California for a couple of years. I stayed at my dad's house for a year. Got in a lot of trouble when I lived there. And it had nothing to do with alcohol. It had to do with some of my natural instincts running astray. And I was 16 years old, and there was a married woman that lived across the street that was 21. And she wanted to show me some stuff. And apparently her husband didn't think much of that. So I've been victimized by females all my life. Cliff is sitting right here. Got sober when I was 10 years old. So I will defer to him. Cliff, don't I look like a victim? Yeah. Got sober in 1954. That's pretty cool, huh? Anyway, they had to put me on a Greyhound bus and get me the hell out of Sacramento and send me back to Illinois where I came from. And then the family back there, they had these telephone things, so the ones in California told the ones in Illinois what I'd been up to, and they got on my ass and wouldn't let me forget anything. And so I decided to slide down to the local Navy recruiter, and I asked for something that would result in something that looked like a geographic. That word was not in my vocabulary, but that's what I wanted real bad. Put me somewhere else. And they were more than happy to do that. We were spooling up to do some stuff in Southeast Asia, and they needed a lot of people. And I enlisted in the Navy because I didn't like people telling me what to do. It's not the worst idea I ever had, I'll tell you. So I was in the Vietnam theater of operations, but I was not in country. I was on an aircraft carrier. I worked on airplanes and single-seat attack aircraft. And sometimes I did it when I was drunk. And my job was to work on ejection seats and things like that, safety and survival stuff. And you really want a drunk working on that stuff. When we were back in this country, They caught us drinking on the flight line and working on. I was working second shift, and we'd drink all afternoon and then go to work and work on things that are supposed to be rather meticulous. So we got in a little trouble here and there, but nothing, no big deal. I got out of the Navy when I was 21 years old. I got married when I was 21. I married a gal that was 19, and I got married because I wanted a partner in life against the world and against whatever the world threw at me, and that woman was never on my side. You know, I wanted a partner, and she was on their side. And I heard a guy in AA one time, he says, if you line up 10 women, he said, I could pick out the sick one every time. And I seemed to have what he had. And it's been an adventure. On page 21 in the big book, it talks about a man that sometimes gets insanely drunk. And has like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde personality. And I happen to be blessed with that, or cursed with it, or whatever you want to call it, however you want to look at that. And sometimes I can drink and act like a human being and just have 3 or 4 drinks and not even get screwed up. And then sometimes I want my share and your share. And sometimes I turn into an animal. Vicious, ugly animal. The problem is I don't get to pick out which time that happens. If I take a thimbleful of alcohol, put it on my tongue and swallow it, I'm going for a ride, and I don't know where the ride's going. And so I'm one of those kind of people who, when drinking, tends to give alcoholism a bad name. I'm one of those kind of people that just kind of look at you and say, man, if I ever get that bad. But then I'm not always that bad. And so I had this, in the book, it talks about an obsession. In the doctor's opinion, it talks about when I'm sober, I become increasingly irritable and restless and discontented until I can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Now, I've been that way since I was 15 years old, you know, since I first experienced that sense of ease and comfort. And I think it's in the 12 and 12, it says, glass in hand we have warped our minds. And I drank finally long enough and hard enough. What time do I quit?
Yeah, it's about 7 minutes
now. Okay. Right. Well, the long version of my story takes 68 years. And it's hard to, and 32 years of sobriety is hard to condense. I'm not going to waste any more time on telling you about my active alcoholism. I'll tell you, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, a man said, being a practicing alcoholic is kind of like riding an elevator to hell. He said, every once in a while, the elevator stops and the doors open, you get a chance. Get off the elevator. Most of us will look out there and say, yeah, it's all right. I'll be okay. Huh. Yeah. Let's see where this goes. And then we find out where it goes. I drank hard enough and long enough to lose a wife and a couple of kids and a house and everything I owned after 13 years of marriage. My father-in-law used to come by the house, and every once in a while he said, you guys ain't going to make it 10 years. We showed him, by God, we suffered for 13. When they said, till death do you part, they had no idea how close we were going to come. Because there was sometimes it was good and sometimes it was ugly. And I wasn't the only alcoholic in that house, but I'm the only one who can share his experience, strength, and hope right now. The other one is still at it sometime, someplace. And I forgot to mention, when I was just getting ready to go overseas, I had an uncle that had joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And his uncle had read the big book about Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came down to visit just before I went overseas, we went to one of my cousin's house and we were playing cards and I was having a few drinks. And he kind of noticed that I had a couple of personality shifts while he's sitting there watching. And maybe I could interest him in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he invited me to go to an AA meeting, and there was a bunch of people that didn't drink. And I wasn't interested in not drinking. I was interested in controlling and enjoying my drinking. So he tried, and I went to AA one night, and the next night I was in Tijuana trying to get that AA stuff flushed out of my system. I punished you guys. I didn't come back for 20 years. I'll show you. I can do this. You know, in the book they call that an obsession. And I looked up the word obsession on advice from other people one time, and they suggested it was an idea so subtly powerful it pushes all other ideas out. You know, like the idea that maybe I shouldn't do that. I drank long enough and hard enough to destroy a marriage. I decided to have a glass of wine with dinner one time. Because what's her name was cooking some Italian food, and that glass of wine turned into a quart and a half, and I drove a nail into the last nail into the coffin that held the marriage. I destroyed it that night. I went into a blackout, and we had a serious conversation. And the next morning she said, "Do you have any idea what you told me last night?" And I said, "I haven't got a clue." You know, the problem with blackouts is sometimes those people you're talking to have witnesses and you don't have any. You don't even have a memory of the... Are you sure that happened? Because that doesn't sound like anything I'd do. I have a file in my filing cabinet at home. It's first divorce. And I open that up, and there's an application for a restraining order in there. That woman and her lawyer lied about some things, and some of the things they didn't lie about. And the things they didn't lie about, I never want to be that guy again. And because of you people, in meetings like this, over the years, I haven't had to be that guy for a long, long time. I never want to meet him again either, because he's ugly. But I got divorced in 1978. I drank. I had been a periodic alcoholic up until that point, but after that, I was a daily drunk, and I still had a job, so I went to work every day. Still took care of my business as best I could, but I was a snot-slinging, knee-walking drunk. And seriously considered suicide. Didn't give a damn whether I lived or died anymore. And one night, I was out running the muck and seeking more companionship, but it's hard to find when you're it. I came out of a blackout, and I had what they call a moment of clarity. And I had a phone number in my wallet for this uncle that had tried to help me get sober when I was 18. I lived 400 miles north of here, and he lived down here. And I called him up, and I said, "Steve, my life's in the toilet. I don't care, and I want to pull a handle. And he said, get your ass down here, and I will help you get started in Alcoholics Anonymous. So in September of 1979, I made the quantum leap from Fresno to San Diego to Chula Vista. And then I tried to be a social drinker for a few more months since I had just done another geographic. And yeah, you know how good geographics work? The problem is, I learned that now, like AA too. Wherever you go, there you are. So, I wasn't sure I was the problem yet, and I had to prove it. Because it was her fault, and it was my mom's fault I turned out that way, and it was my family's fault, and it was my ex-wife's fault, and it was my boss's fault, and everything was everybody else's fault. And I ran out of people to blame. And so my uncle and I, there used to be a Lano Club in Chula Vista, and he sat down with me in this group and gave me a little piece of paper. It's called 20 Questions. And he said, we got a written test to see if you're an alcoholic or not. If you're curious, he said, I'm going to give you this test, and you take it. He says, I'm not going to look at it unless you want me to, and nobody in AA is ever going to see it. This is just for your information. He said, so maybe you could try to tell the truth about your drinking and about what it does to you. I said, okay. So I took this test. On the bottom of that test, it says if you answer yes to three or more of these, you may be an alcoholic. I answered yes to 17, and I lied on 2. It's been a long time since I was in school, but I think that's an A, isn't it? I got an A in alcoholism. Whoopee. There's still, if I took that test again and standing here in front of you, there's still one question I can't say yes to. And it says, is there a certain time of day each day that you want to take a drink? I didn't care what time it was. Clock has not been one of my problems. So I got an A in alcoholism. So then he took me down to the South Bay Pioneers, and said they're just getting ready to have a meeting. And he sat next to me, and they asked for anybody that's less than 30 days, please stand up and identify yourself. And he had to keep sticking his elbow in my ribs because I didn't want to say nothing, and I didn't want to stand up. But it's the first time I stood up in front of witnesses and said, I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had to put alcohol in my mouth and swallow it since that point in time. And that's 32 years ago, almost 33 years ago. And I'm incredibly grateful. I feel incredibly blessed. And in 32 years, I have watched a lot of people come and go around here. And I have yet to see anybody come in here and say, man, I went back out and it was wonderful. And you guys don't know what the hell you're doing. Never seen that happen yet. I'm waiting. I'm not going to do any research. I'm waiting to watch them. And mostly our scouts come back with an ass full of arrows. And the ones that are lucky enough to come back. A whole bunch of them don't. A whole bunch of them didn't. And I know some of them personally. I was on page 52 in the big book is a thing called the bedevilments. And this is it's a thumbnail sketch of what I looked like or what my life was like when I walked in the doors of AA. Said we were having trouble with personal relationships. Couldn't control my emotional nature. I was a prey to misery and depression. I had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of help of other people. And that's pretty much a good thumbnail sketch of what it was like for me. I was scared to death, petrified. Didn't want anybody to know it, though, so I would put on my best facade. In our big book, it says most alcoholics are actors. They like to present a stage character to everybody they meet. This is who I am. And all the time, that's who I am over there, you know. So honesty's not our strong suit when we first come here. The program says we have to be rigorously honest, but that's the program. Some of the people are kind of short on that, and I was one of those for a long time. The first couple of years I was sober was on fear, fellowship, and a high sugar diet. I probably drank like 60 or 70 cups of coffee a day. I smoked 2.5 to 4 packs of cigarettes a day. High sugar diet, candy when I get hungry, just crazier than shit. And that's not a four-letter word, is it? Oh, okay. My uncle introduced me to his sponsor. His sponsor's name was Birch. And Birch had been sober for 27 years. My uncle didn't want to sponsor me because he had his own problems at that point in time. So he gave me a big book and a sponsor. And that old man loved me. He loved me when I was unlovable. He loved me with my attitude, when my attitude absolutely sucked. Give me reading assignments in the big book. After I'd been there for a little bit, we used to get 12-step calls at the South Bay Pioneers. They'd come in the office down there. After I'd been sober for about 6 months, he started making me go on 12-step calls, you know. And I said things to him like, yeah, I don't know how to help those people. I don't know what this is about. He says, good, then you won't try to help them. He says, just go and listen to what the other guys are saying to them, and then you'll learn something. So I got to learn and observe alcoholism from a different perspective. Instead of doing my own research, I watched somebody else doing research. And the first 12-step call we went on, we went, beautiful Sunday day, beautiful day. We went over to this really nice townhouse, and there's a guy in bed with 2 quarts of booze. He couldn't even get out of bed to go get it himself. He had to have a cab driver bring it. And we walked in there, and this guy I'm with says, you want a drink or you want to get sober? And the guy says, I'm going to drink. And he says, well, you know where we're at if you ever get interested. And we left. So I went back and told my sponsor about this guy. He said, you know what he said, you know? And Birch said, that's a successful 12-step call. I said, what? He said, did you drink? And I said, no, sir. And he said, you're successful. Okay, things. People in AA think funny stuff, and he talked to me about the first step. And the first step is that I'm powerless over alcohol. My life has become unmanageable. And what the first step meant to him, he said, there's no decision you can make about whether you drink or not that's going to hold up. Because lack of power is our dilemma. So we kicked that around for a while until I could halfway understand it. And then we talk about the second step. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And the insanity I thought he was talking about was what I did when I was drunk. And how I drove and how I treated people and random acts of violence that I would get into and those kinds of things. He said, that's not what we're talking about in that step. He says, knowing all of that stuff can happen, and then you make a decision while you're stone cold sober to go buy alcohol, pour it in your mouth, and swallow it. Knowing all that stuff can happen to you because it's happened how many countless times, you know? Blackouts, alcohol poisoning, fights, courtrooms, police people, all that stuff. Make a decision while I'm sober to do that again. That's insanity. And so, you know, after, okay, my power is over alcohol, and my life's unmanageable, and I'm crazy. So I might need new management. That's what the third step's about, getting some new management. So he's. I had this attitude about God from the time I was 10 or 12 years old. I had a four-year-old cousin burned to death in a fire. Beautiful little blonde-haired, blue-eyed little girl. Caught herself on fire and died. And then her brother, a couple of years later, drowned, and he was 13. And I thought God did all that stuff. So I remember distinctly telling God when I was a kid that I don't want you in my life if that's what you're all about. I won't pray to you. I'm not going to bother you for anything, and you leave me alone. And he did his share. He left me alone. Probably saved my life a few times, but no doubt in my mind that happened. So I need to do this third step. And then I'm making friends with this little brunette. And she said when she did her third step, she went up in the mountains and they did took the book and did that. And she said, "Would you like to do that?" And I wanted what she had. And I was willing to go to any length to get it. And if that means you want to drive up to the mountains and say a prayer, who am I to deprive you? So we did that, and it took me a year and a half to get out of that deal. But the prayer took. In spite of my motives being pretty poor, the prayer took. It did not change my relationship with my ex-wife. It didn't change my relationship with the district attorney's office and revenue and recovery and all of them kind of folks. But it changed the way I felt about it. You know, all of a sudden I get this little nagging feeling that everything's going to be okay. You know? So I lived with that gal for about a year and a half. We bought some... We bought some rings, and we were going to do this. One time, I walked in the room, and she's talking to this girl she sponsors, and the one I'm living with says, "That spiritual shit's for guys. That ain't for us, man. Don't worry about that stuff." And I thought, strange. I just started hearing things, you know, and it became operative for me to get the hell out of there, I was coming up on 2 years sober. I had a job. I started a new job out in Lakeside in a machine shop, and they hired me because they were getting ready to retire one of the department heads, and they were going to try to groom me for the job because I had been a supervisor previously in a couple other jobs, and I had after a year and a half. I was the lead man in that department, and I had seven guys working for me, and I blew out my back real bad and couldn't do the work anymore. I had three herniated discs and a bunch of stuff. They wanted to do surgery on my back. Anyway, so I had to leave that job, and that happened to coincide at the same time I'm splitting up with this gal. The South Bay Pioneers, I had a couple of friends that were on the board of directors, and they were worried for me that I was going through all this crap all at the same time. So they asked me if I would like to come and hang out at the South Bay Pioneers and live upstairs for about 10 days or for a couple of weeks until I started getting my head out of my butt So I did that, and then one of the guys on the board of directors was living by himself. He was a manager of the San Diego Country Club, and he said, "You come down and kick around. I got a guest room, and you come down and hang out until you get back on your feet and get a job and get things going again." So I did that, and one day I'm telling, his name was Chuck Talbot, and one day I'm telling Chuck, you know, I was married for 13 years and I lost everything in the world when that marriage went away. I mean, I went from a three-bedroom, two-bath house with a swimming pool in the backyard to everything I own fit in the back of the pickup truck. And uh, So I lost everything then, and I said, now I've been sober for almost 2 years, and everything was going up, I was working, and everything was good, and now I've lost everything again. I said, I feel like an all-time loser, man. I said, I ought to jump off the bridge. So Chuck says, well, if you really want to do that, get in a car and I'll drive you up there. He said, if you take your vehicle, they have to send a tow truck up there and get it, and it inconveniences a lot of people. Harbor police, I mean, just really a mess. So if you want to jump, get in a car. And I said, I didn't think that was funny. And, I thought he was being insensitive. AA people are insensitive sometimes. And then he slid this legal pad across the table with me and a pencil. And he says, let's take your inventory now. He said, you've been sitting here taking everybody else's. Now let's take yours. In our book, it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of all of our problems. I didn't see how that applied to me. I really didn't. And so I started doing this. I did what I did about at that point in time for an inventory. I took it to my sponsor. My sponsor said, I want you to make an appointment with this guy in National City and go down and do your fifth step with him. That doesn't apply to me either. Okay. I got to hurry up and get sober. The guy's name was Bill Wilson, ironically. He was a Catholic priest, and I did a fifth step with him, and when I walked out of that room, just before I left, it took several hours, and I told him all that stuff I was never going to tell anybody. And then he said, in all your life, you've never made a mistake yet that was not absolutely necessary to bring you to here and now. So you can learn how to make better decisions, or you can keep doing that other crap, but we have an option now. And that kind of took the weight of the world off my back, because all my life I've been criticized by not well-meaning people, and I learned how to be my greatest critic. I just about beat myself to death every time I did anything. And to find out that those things were necessary as a learning tool. And guys in AA said, look on problems like bad weather, unpleasant, but it doesn't last. Well, where was that your wisdom when I needed it? When I was a kid coming up, These AA people know a lot of stuff. The people in Alcoholics Anonymous have saved my bacon multiple times. I retired in 2004. In 2006, I was involved in a pretty good motorcycle accident. I broke a couple of bones in my right leg. AA people, instead of letting me go to a convalescent hospital, they took me into their home. And a friend of mine, his wife was a retired RN. His daughter was an RN, and their other daughter was an LVN. And they all lived in the same house. So I had wonderful care. They kept me for months, took me to all my doctors. Well, I couldn't drive. I couldn't do anything. I was wheelchair bound. And recently I just had another bout in the hospital, and AA people one more time just rescued me and took care of me. And since I'm running out of time and this man's very impatient, I'm going to close with, I'm going to read a little poem to you that I heard when I was really new sober, and it really, really touched me, and I would like to share it with you. And it's called The Touch of the Master's Hand. And it goes, 'Twas battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it hardly worth his while to waste much time on that old violin, but he held it up with a smile. What am I bid, good people, he cried. Who'll start the bidding for me? $1, $1, do I hear two? $2, who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, going for three, but no. From the room far back, a gray-bearded man came forward and picked up the bow. Then wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening up the strings, he played a melody, pure and sweet as the angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, "Now, what am I bid for this old violin?" And he held it aloft with its bow. $1,000. $1,000. Do I hear two? $2,000. Who makes three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice. Going and gone, said he. The audience cheered, but some of them cried, "We just don't understand. What changed its worth?" Swift came the reply, "The touch of the master's hand." And many a man with life out of tune, all battered with bourbon and gin, is auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He's going once, he's going twice, he's going and almost gone. But the master comes. And the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of a soul and the change that is wrought by the touch of the master's hand. Thank you for letting me share in your meeting.